Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why episode 283, my interview with Travis Charles Plager, the director of Washington Improv Theater's iMusical, the improvised musical. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook download, as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts, including this one. Yes, you can listen to Yes But Why podcast through the Audible app if you like. Do it now. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Sign up and get your account today. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. We want to be there for you. Let us help you with whatever you need for your podcast. Mention code YBY20 and you'll get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. We can help. PodcastCadet.com. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my resource for vegan-friendly whole plant extract CBD oil. Check out TrueHempScience.com to see all of the CBD products available to you now. Use code YESBUTY7 to get 7% off your order of $50 or more. Plus, you'll get a free packet of 2 CBD edibles with your order. Yum. TrueHempScience.com. This week on Yes But Why podcast, I talked to music director Travis Charles Plager. From singing in a professional touring choir to creating improvised musicals in Washington, D.C., Travis tells me about all of his musical adventures. The guy's first word was piano. It's no wonder the only thing we talked about was music. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 283, Travis Charles Plager of iMusical and his lifelong love affair with music. Enjoy! Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah. All right, so I like to open up with a question about your childhood. You know, what kind of creative games were you playing as a child?
Creative games. I had a piano when I was really, really, really little. When I was in kindergarten, my parents actually bought like a full blown piano. They took a risk on me and the full blown piano. I was playing the little tiny Schrader piano before I could walk. But they took a risk as a kindergartner and they bought the real piano. And so for creative games, I would make up songs on the piano, like not lyrics, but the music. And, yeah. it would be like question answer kinds of things, right? So like I would see the weather or the dog or whatever. And then I would like make a little tune that was about whatever I was looking at and seeing. And then copying that and making a little different, but I was making music, making up little songs on the piano. That was the creative game I did.
I like how you scoffed at creative games. Like, you're like, what? I don't know what you mean by creativity. By the way, I invented songs on a piano. Like, what? you're like the most creative, and you're like, I don't know, do I do creativity? I only did this one thing, like compose some music. I don't know, it's not a big deal or whatever. Like, what?
Well, I think creative games, I'm like, oh wait, well, I didn't like invent a new version of tic-tac-toe or something.
Come on. Who am I talking to? What is this?
That's what I would do for creativity is I'd be goofing around on a piano.
Oh my God, man, I would have been satisfied with, like, I played with some sticks and I made like a house out of sticks. Like, this is not, I'm not looking,
that's what,
like,
I remember. So that's what I remember.
So you went to Juilliard at the age of three? Like, that's really the caliber of people. No, but okay. No, I was just harassing you back for your scoff at the creative games. I was like, what? It was just a phrase. Oh man. No, okay. So clearly you are super creative and funny, but we've started with the music. Did you, when you were a little kid, were you like truly processing the idea that you were writing songs for things? Like,
no. Well, it yes, to be honest, yes. Like, I knew I was making up stuff, but I thought that it was more like anyone who could play the piano could also make up stuff on the piano. Like, I wasn't really connecting for a long time that improvising music on a piano and making up songs on the piano was a different skill than just outright playing piano or playing by ear. That was something that I could do, right? So, like, I could hear stuff and then put it on the piano. I wasn't like Elton John in like the movie where he's just like hearing something and playing it completely. I'm not that good at it, but I can, you know, I hear something and I can play it, right? I can play by ear. That's what I can do.
Yeah.
And, but for a long time, like, I didn't put together that playing by ear is a different skill than writing music on the spot. Like, I thought that was like the same thing.
Sure.
And you don't know what you don't know. So yeah, it took a while for me to realize, oh wait, this thing that I do, not everybody that plays piano does that.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it is a very special skill. It's like, to be able to look at music that way, I think you're right, is totally different, sort of certainly brain hemisphere wise, I bet, than just learning where you're supposed to put your fingers and what the noises are that come out when you press them. Like, there's this creation, there's this idea, also the confidence that comes from believing you can, right? There's something, like, some people just don't even acknowledge they have the ability to do stuff, right? They're like, I could never write a story. You're like, you've written six novels. What are you talking about? Like, as opposed to, like, there's this way that you're understanding music, and it's like, I love the idea that we're like, wait, not everybody does this? It's like Dr. Doolittle. You're like, nobody else talks to animals? What's happening?
Nobody else talks to the lion? No one else does that.
Wow, that is unexpected. But so you were writing music, you were just creating, were your parents like super over the moon for this like skill?
Yeah, they were super excited about it. I mean, like, they were happy that I was happy to be playing music all the time, and they quickly gave me lessons. And so I started taking piano lessons. And then as a teenager, I was like, oh, piano's not cool. I want to play bass guitar. So I started playing bass guitar for a while. Mm-hmm, and but then I really went back to piano in high school and like full-blown like was like writing music and like actually like, oh, I'm gonna be a song, yeah, I'm gonna writing songs, I'm a songwriter, I'm writing songs.
Yeah.
And when you go back to it on your own, then like, you know, you want it, right?
Yeah.
And so that was cool. Although I wasn't thinking, I was still thinking that aspect of playing music and writing songs, that was more the hobby, that was more this is the thing I do for fun. I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be on Broadway. That's what I wanted to do.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that the music was, I thought that was just like something that would help and it would be, you know, my other artistic thing that I do. But all along, I thought I was going to be on Broadway. I was going to be a Broadway actor. That's what I thought I was going to do.
What made you want to be an actor? Like, what inspired you to have the, you know, dreams of being on Broadway?
I would say I like the energy you get when you do something, and usually be like funny, right? I mean, I would crack a joke or make some smart comment. But I was a singer. I am a singer. Being able to make people happy and applaud and getting that audience feedback of like, oh, wow, I'm really impressing people with this thing that I'm liking to do. And it's an addiction. It's a drug. It's a juice. And you're like, oh, wow, that was awesome. I want more of that. I want to do some more of that. Very quickly through middle school and high school, I wouldn't choose sports. I would choose the theater. I was part of a professional touring choir, the Metropolitan Boys Choir. I grew up in Minnesota in the Twin Cities, and I toured with them all over the country from like the age of like 9 to like 14. So I was in this singing touring choir, just the idea of performing and singing in front of others and acting. I did summer theater. I did high school shows. Like I was like, yeah, I want to be an actor, and that's what I want to do.
Yeah. It was great that you had the opportunity to get involved with like summer stock stuff and do plays and even this touring choir. That's pretty sweet. I mean, like, clearly your parents saw that you were, a musician, artistic from the early ages, but like, how did you just like get involved in these like touring things and all the summer stock? I didn't know there was summer theater until I was in college, and then I was like, wait, what? Every summer of my life I could have been doing this. Why didn't anyone mention this to me, right? But like, how did you find out?
They were super supportive. I mean, like, they recognized that, hey, you know, he's got this talent. He's a talented kid. He's not afraid to speak in front of other people and do things. He's playing piano. My first word was piano. They were looking and seeking out opportunities for me. And the Twin Cities has tons of art stuff in it. So, I mean, like, I was fortunate to be, you know, I wasn't in, you know, Dubuque or Harrisburg, although I'm sure there are lovely arts communities in Dubuque and Harrisburg, but
it's okay. There's a lot of cities and you're like, clearly right. There should be a lot. And then I talk to people there and they're like, oh no, there's nothing. So you just never know what major metropolitan cities are going to be like absolutely empty of theater. You just don't know.
Well, the Twin Cities has it. That wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was very, very fortunate to be growing up there. Elementary music school teacher recommended me to the touring choir, that was such a wonderful experience, because it was instilling on an early age for me professionalism with this craft. So it's not enough to like to do something, and it's not enough to be good at something, but you have to combine those things and actually put a product together that is respectable, that people want to see.
Yeah.
And you have to behave a certain way to make that happen. And you have to practice, and you have to have a common mission, a common goal. It was important to deliver. And that was instilled very early on from experiences like that.
Yeah. It sounds like you had a very well-rounded sort of childhood theater experience. You know, I was shuffled between random, like, you know, hippie acting schools and I did like two plays in high school. And then I was like, I understand everything. I'm going to theater school. And then I went to a liberal arts college and got a theater degree, and different than theater school. But, you know, I had no idea of all the opportunities that there were there. I love that Twin Cities has a lot of that. Like, that's wonderful that there is so much available, that there is so many artistic possibilities for kids and adults alike. That's really wonderful. So did you also go to, you want to be on Broadway? Did you go to acting school, or did you go to liberal arts school like me?
So when I was in high school, in the middle of high school, my family, we moved, my dad changed jobs. And so we moved to the East Coast, and we were in Taunton, Massachusetts.
Oh.
And, that got me to the East Coast. So then when it was time to go to college, I was really looking more at East Coast colleges. And, the top two schools for me that I wanted to go to after doing a lot of research and stuff that you did back then, I wanted to go to, NYU to go to Tisch.
Mm.
And then I wanted to go to, the Hart School of Music. It's called the Hart School now, but I wanted to go to the Hart School of Music. That's what it was then.
Mm.
So those were the two. And so, my parents took me to the audition, for both of them. For the Tisch audition, we were hustled. I'm sitting in the lobby and, of the auditorium where they're doing the audition to, cause you know, for these schools, you have to audition to get in them. It's not just enough to apply and have good grades or whatever, but you have to prepare a monologue. You have to have a song. You have to all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I'm in the lobby. And I'm wearing what I consider to be my awesome audition outfit of like a sweater and jeans, and like I wasn't super dressed up. And I mean, it was nice jeans, you know, it was a nice sweater, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't super dressed up. And the kid sitting across from me was in all black. He looked like Dieter from Saturday Night Live. It was like black pants, black shirt, buttoned up, greased hair. It was really tall, lanky. I'm tall, but he was taller than me. And he was very serious. And I'm like, oh, maybe I'm not supposed to be doing it. This is what it's for. And so we go inside, and there are a bunch of other people inside, a couple of teachers, and about, I don't know, like eight or nine other kids who are going to audition, students. There was one other kid who was kind of like me, dressed kind of casual, but everybody else was in all black. Like, I felt like I was in like a candy camera thing or something. Like, and this is where we insert, for the people who don't know what candy camera is, they can go look that up later. I thought it was a spoof. I thought it was that everyone was dressed in black. And so we're all, and I'm like, oh my God, what's going on? So we're all in a circle, and the teacher's like, okay, so we're going to get to your monologues and your songs. We're going to do all that, but I like to do a group exercise first so we can all get to know each other. So what this is I'm going to, I want you to say your name, but before your name, I want you to say an adjective that describes yourself and then a physical motion. So I'm going to start. My name's Jonna. I'm Jealous Jonna. And she went, Jealous Jonna, ah, like that. And so then we all had to go, Jealous Jonna, ah. And she was two persons on the circle. So it was her. And then the kid who I was waiting with in the lobby was next and in between us.
Yeah.
And so she looks at him, and he goes, Isolated Pete, and then like hops and turns around in like a half circle. And
poor Isolated Pete.
And I burst out laughing. Like I lose it. I absolutely lose it. And I laugh for like 5 seconds. And 5 seconds is a long time to laugh when you think about it, right? So then I look up and I notice that no one else is laughing, and they're all looking at me, and poor Isolated Pete, he's starting to cry, his eyes are watering.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So it comes to me and I'm like, I'm terrible Travis. Terrible Travis. That's me. Terrible Travis. And I went like, oh, terrible Travis. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So I knew right there that I probably wasn't gonna want to go to Tisch School of Acting NYU.
I feel like you got peed in, though. Like, I feel like they would finish that and just be like, are we going to kick Pete in the dick after that? We can't. We can't. Let him in. Let him in. And that was Johnny Depp. That was Johnny yes. Depp. That's right. How.
That's right. That's right. And so that, and that, and that's how his legend was born. So, yeah.
Isolated Pete. Poor kid. Yeah. Like, I hope he actually did do well and he didn't, like, you know, fail out and is sad.
Yeah.
And may listen yeah. to this at the Dairy Queen because he remembers you, terrible Travis.
And I felt awful, right? I felt awful.
Yes.
I thought it was a joke.
Sure.
Like, I had no idea how serious everyone had taken this moment.
Yep.
And so on the ride home, and I do my audition, and it goes fine. But on the ride home, I'm really doubting. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, like, is this what going to acting school? Cause I heard everything is awesome about NYU. It's one of the best in the country. And blah, blah. I'm like, is this what it's supposed to be like? Do I have to be like isolated Pete? Is that what's expected of me? And then I went to the Hart School of Music audition afterwards, and that audition was in what looked like one of their like smaller auditorium spaces. There were two, I was just in by myself. There were two guys there. They both were wearing flannels. One guy had his dog with him. And it was super casual. And I did my audition for them, but it was more talking to them. And at the end of that, I told my parents, I'm like, man, I hope I get in here because this is the place I want to go to school. Because yeah. these people, they look like they're normal. They look like they're actually like people like I would want to talk to.
Oh,
I did get into both, and I did not choose to hang with Isolated Pete. Instead, I chose the Hart School of Music.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting that, like, you got in and you made that decision. I mean, I think of the hundreds of thousands of people who are right now going like, oh, what? I didn't get in.
What's going on?
Why, you should have taken it. But you're right. The vibe of the people, I mean, like, you're going to spend time with them. It's like casting a movie. It's like later when they're talking about this thing. It's like, dude, they're not trying to find out who really is the best for the role. They're trying to figure out who they want to hang out with for 2 years. Like, you know what I mean? Like, a movie's not like a short-term scenario. There, you have to see you a lot. They need to want to see you a lot, right?
Yes.
And then that college, you know, they before they let you in, they called Isolated Pete, and they're like, listen, we want to let terrible Travis in. He was pretty good. And he was like, he was pretty good. I thought I liked his song. And you're like, they're like, can we find a way? Maybe you guys can be roommates so that you can, like, make that bridge. And he was like, yes, yes, I will allow that. And then they're like,
I don't know.
Isolated Pete, I'm so sorry that we're calling you back about this. I just want to let you know. Terrible Travis says he does not want to go to NYU, probably because of you. I'm not saying that it is you, but it probably is you, that he decided not to go to, like, the best school, like, in the country. But don't worry about it. We'll find you a good roommate. I'm sure. Okay. Hello, Isolated Pete. It was a tough time.
I don't know how many lives I've actually affected with this decision. Ripples.
You know what's the funny, ripples. Though? I'm glad it's a good story. I like it because it's like, when you're choosing where to go for school, when you're choosing where to, like, take a job, you know, that you're going to be for a while, you really have to take into account, like, is this my crowd? Is this who I want to hang out with? Right. I did not go to NYU. However, after I graduated from college, I went and got a job at NYU, and I stage managed for some of their Tisch stuff. So, sure. I was there and received some information into my brain as they were being taught, and I just stood in the back with my notebook, right?
Excellent.
But it was very serious. Like, everyone took everything, like, super, super seriously. So, you know, you were right. The vibe there has this, like, tone of like, do you know how crucial this is? And if that's not the vibe you're looking for in like school, then you don't, you know, maybe you dodged a bullet. Like, it sounds like Hart School of Music was like sweet. It was fun. They were in flannel. I don't know what year it was. I'm going to assume it was the 90s, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It was mid 90s. And the
perfect.
At Hart, I could get a Bachelor of Music degree.
Oh.
Whereas at Tisch, it was a BFA. But with Hart, it was a music school, and yeah. They had a music theater program in the music school. And so I'm like, oh wow, I can actually get a Bachelor of Music degree, but also do theater. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is what I want. Yeah.
Now, so, was this experience the first time that you found other people who had your special skill of writing music? Like, or were there people like throughout your growing up where you'd meet other people and they'd be like, yeah, I write music. And you're like, oh, cool. We're part of this special. Like, not everyone can do this. Did you know?
Not yet. Not at this point. When I was at Hart, one of the guys in the flannels, Roger Ames, he hooked me up with a gig at a school next door called the Watkinson School. And it was a private middle school, high school. And, I got hooked up there to be their resident composer. And I was teaching middle school and high school students theater stuff with a resident choreographer that was there and a resident drama teacher. And the three of us, Betty Ann Libin was the choreographer and Terry Schrader was the drama teacher there. The three of us, we were teaching music theater technique, by having the kids create original pieces. So I would be writing, but it would be more improvising with the kids to get them to be, you know, figuring out how to sing a little bit to music, and I would change things and they would change things and be at dance and acting, and they would create these pieces. And then that's how we would teach the technique. And Roger saw that ability in me to give me that kind of a gig, but I still wasn't really connecting the on the spot part of it yet.
Yeah.
I still wasn't really, it still felt like, well, I'm a writer. I'm a songwriter. See,
sure.
Not to mention, I mean, like, you know, yeah, I'm instantly writing the songs, but you know, that's the thing that I wasn't like clued into that was like that special. But I'm writing the songs. I'm writing stuff with that. Fast forward to, all right, I've graduated. I'm going to move to New York City. I got some auditions and prior to moving to New York, I didn't move to New York for a couple of years because I managed to get summer stock auditions that got me gigs for about a year and a half after I graduated, before I even had to then move into New York. So I moved into New York about a year and a half after school, and I start auditioning. I got a temp job for the daytime, and then I'm auditioning and doing stuff. And a friend of mine, was in a sketch group called Mouth, and she was like, hey, our sketch group that we're in, I've never seen their sketch group, we're gonna do this spoof of the Titanic musical, because that was out on Broadway at the time, and it's gonna be called The Towering Inferno. And it's gonna be like 15 minutes long. We've got some lyrics, but no one knows how to write any music. And I was like, hey, can you come help us? Can you come do this? I'm like, oh yeah, sure, that'll be fun. So I go to their rehearsals and I start and I help them write the music for this sketch, for this Towering Inferno sketch. And I'm also playing like little interstitials in between their sketches and, you know, making up little music and stuff. And one of the other cast members of that sketch group, her name was Mary Purdy, and she was also in Chicago City Limits. And she told me, she said, hey, you know, I'm in this show, Chicago City Limits, and we do, you know, and I'd heard Chicago City Limits living in New York City at that point. And she said, yeah, they're looking for pianists all the time. They're always looking for pianists because whenever the pianist is sick, they have no one to call. Can I give your name to them? And I said, yeah, sure. I mean, I'd heard of Chicago City Limits, but I didn't really know what it was. I knew it was a comedy show, but I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. So some months go by, and a Saturday night, I get a call at like 6 o'clock at night. And it's this guy named Jay Stern. He's like, yeah, hi, I'm Jay Stern. I'm the producer for, I'm one of the producers for Chicago City Limits. Your name is on a call list here for substitutes for pianists. Can you come in and do the show this evening? And I said, I've never seen your show, Jay. I don't know how you got my number. And he's like, I'm sorry about that. Are you home tomorrow? I'm like, yeah, I'm home tomorrow. Well, we'll send someone tomorrow to train you to do the show. And I'm like, okay, all right, great. So the next night, Sunday night, Rob Schiffman comes to my apartment, and he was the music director of the touring company for Chicago City Limits. So he comes to my apartment, and he basically like teaches me the show, what the different bits. There's a Jeopardy game. There's a ding game, hit the bell, new choice game. He goes through this different series of games, and he like tests me a little bit, like, like play something that sounds like Shakespeare, play something that sounds like the blues or jazz or, cowboy time and stuff like that. So like he was testing me to see if I could do these different kinds of genres with the same kind of music. Play Twinkle Twinkle's Little Star as if it was, classical music. Well, it kind of is already. Well, now play it like it's a rodeo, and now play it like it's a horror film, stuff like that. And so I was doing that kind of stuff with him. And he's like, okay, yeah, this will be fun. This will be good. He's like, can you come to our rehearsal tomorrow night? Because at that time, the touring company would rehearse on Monday evenings. I'm like, yeah, sure. That sounds great. I would love to do that. So I show up the next night, Monday night, and they were rehearsing at like 5:30 or 5 o'clock. And so I show up, and I'm at the rehearsal, and I'm kind of sitting with him on the piano, and we're doing stuff. And then the director of the show says, hey, do you want to play the show tonight? You sound like you kind of got it. I mean, there's not much more than what we're doing in rehearsal here, except there's just an audience. That's all. But it's what you're doing now. And I'm like, sure, why not? Because it was pretty easy. Like it was not something that felt difficult to me. It was something that it really felt just like I was playing around. And I'm like, yeah, sure. This is fun. It was so no pressure. I'm like, why not? So I played the show that night. And then the next morning, I get a call from the producer, the main producer, who says, hey, do you want to be the music director for the touring company? And I'm like, what? And I come to find out that Rob Schiffman wanted to be on stage performing in the show and not behind the piano. And so there was kind of an unwritten kind of, well, if you can find someone to take your place, you can actually be in the, you can do the show. So he was very eager to get someone like me to step in. And it worked out. And so I went from a Saturday night never seeing the show to Tuesday morning being the music director of the national touring company for the show. And that was in 1998. That was in January of 1998. And then from there, that's when I really stopped auditioning to be on Broadway and auditioning to be in shows, because I realized, oh my goodness, that there, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there are lots of talented singers and actors in New York City.
I've heard about that.
There are lots of them. but I saw the list that they had upstairs at Chicago City Limits, that back then they had their own theater on 1st and 60th on the Upper East Side. And I saw the list of pianists, and there were like six names, and that was it. And it wasn't just like there were six names on their list. Like, no, there are only like six names in New York City that can do this job, that can do this gig. And once I put that together, I was like, oh, wait a second. And this pays and I can like, and I'm having fun and I'm actually like in demand for this thing. I'm like, maybe I should shift what I want to be doing. Maybe I should be doing this instead. And it just, it opened up this opened the whole world to me.
Yeah. Did it fulfill you in the same way that you felt being on stage was?
It was incredible. It was incredible. It was, I would play things. I would see the actors do stuff. And then I would be underscoring what they would do. I'd be making up music and influencing what their choices would be based on what they were hearing me do. And I would hear them do stuff. And then I would play stuff based on that. And we weren't even yet really doing musical improv at that point. I mean, there were some of the games were involving making up songs on the spot. And so I had to be able to keep the progression and be able to follow an actor and be able to indicate with what I was playing on the keys to help get them to play, to sing with my music. So I had to have that kind of communication back and forth. But there's a difference between, doing just an occasional song or having just a quick like joke or series of lines in a scene, go into a song and then do something else versus actually doing a full blown improvised musical. And the Chicago City Limits show at that time would end the show or end the first act with an improvised musical. And it usually lasts about 20, 25 minutes or so. And it would be, they would interview the audience, maybe interview an audience member, and then we would improvise the music. And that aspect of it was the best part for me of the whole thing was like, oh wow, we're making up a musical, like, and I'm writing the musical with the actors, and that was way more fulfilling to me than singing on stage pre-written stuff or performing a role and then doing that role over and over again.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you find new life in it and you're making each moment new, and it's the first time every time when as an actor, like all of that, it's all true. But as true as that is, it's not as literally true as first time every time when it is new every time, literally new, because you're making it up, because it is brand new every time.
Yeah.
And that was such a rush to be like, we just made this song. We just created this moment. And it didn't exist before now. And the audience ate it up. That was such a rush. And to know that I was controlling so much of it from my space, that was way more fulfilling than being Algernon in Towards Being Earnest, or
yeah,
I don't know.
Plus, you're getting such direct attention. Like, you're not getting attention as the guy who played Algernon. You're getting attention, right, you know, as Travis. Check out what Travis can do. Watch him do it, guys. And you're like, da 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 da. And they're like, oh my God, he's amazing at things.
How's he doing that?
Like, they're not like, oh, I think I get what he's playing in that role or whatever. They're like, seeing your skills and like excited for you and your skills to be in the show. Like, it's so much more from the point of view of like, I want to be an actor because I want people to be like, wow, she's really good at stuff. But as an actor, you know, you're often playing other people. So I personally, in my own life, I much prefer like hosting stuff and like leading things where it's like, it's me. That's also kind of why I do this podcast, right? Because it's about me. It's me, right? I'm not like playing a character who's a podcaster. It's like my life, my experience within the stories that you're telling. But like, it's somehow so much better. And also from this point of view of like, so the story you've told me so far of like, I'm a tiny child, and like I was all like blank, blank, blank. Hey, do you know I could write songs? And then like it turns into a full blown job. Like, dude, that's amazing. What'd your parents say?
Yeah, well, they were. I think they were a little disappointed that I wasn't going to try to be on Broadway anymore. I'll tell you.
Really interesting. Yeah. They're all like, "Don't give up your dream, man. Don't do it."
Yeah.
Wow, interesting. Diehards. I like them. They're into it.
But I mean, let's be clear. I mean, like they appreciated what the joy and the uniqueness of what I was doing. And I'm sure it amazed them. I mean, it amazes me sometimes when I watch this crap, I watch this art form, it amazes me that it can happen in such a good way, in mm-hmm. such a moving way. I'm sure they're happy that, okay, we paid for music school and he's doing something that has to do with music. So
I mean,
there you go.
It's
there
working you go.
It out. It worked. No, they were very proud of me. They were thrilled.
I bet you they love coming to see shows. I mean, like when they saw you do it, they were like, wow, look at how amazing our kid is.
They would come to New York and they would see the show, whenever they would come and visit. They were still in Massachusetts. And when we were tour near Massachusetts, they would always come and bring all their friends and, you know, show off a little bit. There's our boy making up the songs.
Yeah. There wouldn't be a song if not for him. That's my genes.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, absolutely.
the professionalism aspect of it, that it all was clicking together. I mean, there was when you're acting, and I did acting. I mean, I did do that. And before I got the Chicago State, before I did the music director, and before I did the music improv stuff. Yes, there's ownership and professionalism that you have to do with that to be successful with it. But in the position where you're at the piano making up the moment, when you're improvising it with another improviser, and that's your take, like you're writing it and having to perform it, and it has to deliver. And if it doesn't work, your stage mate, your partner has to make it work. And if they can't make it work together, then the next person comes in and tries to make it work. And like it's about delivering the product and rescuing each other and making whatever it is gold. And that need to have something that is worthwhile on stage and not just screwing around, not just having fun, but having fun in a way that is worth someone spending their money to sit down and watch, that the creation aspect of it for me was such a rush and such a so different from when you had your lines correct and had your acting moment correct on stage. It was such a different feeling because you were the one owning that moment and having to create it with your scene partner or with the pianist. I'm at the keys and I'm making up this musical moment with people on stage, and we didn't rehearse it, and the audience ate it up, and they didn't eat it up as a gimmick. They ate it up because it was just happening and they enjoyed the theater of it. That was way more powerful than simply doing pre-written material.
Oh my God, absolutely. The idea of connectedness that has to happen in a musical improv troupe, like, cause you're right. The deepest commitment to yes and that any improv troupe has ever had to do is in musical improv. Like, they so have to, like, be in it together, like find a way to make the music make sense. It's like the best example of, you know, you do a scene and you're like, somebody throws you something out of left field. And, you know, I've seen 1,000 times somebody will be like, nah, I'm going to throw that away. I'm sorry, you can't do that when there's a guy
no.
who's playing the thing. You can't be like, oh, you didn't like this fast beat? Too bad, it's happening. Sing it, make it work out. You know, whatever it might be that you need to do, you still need to deal with it, right? There's something so beautiful about that. Now, in your story, you're telling me you're getting this job kind of out of nowhere, and yet you're doing improv. Did you at any point previous to this or after this have to take an improv class to kind of be like, oh, by the way?
No, they just tossed
you right into it. They're like, here's some fire, jump in. And you're like, I got it.
I mean, I have, you know, I had enough theater experience, and I'm a musician enough that I knew the musical theater aspect of it enough to be able to accompany musical theater moments, and a lot of the comedy show. I mean, a lot of what that improv comedy stuff. Chicago City Limits was like a mix of short form improv, which is just the quick games, game to game, different games, and long form improv. They would sometimes do a very series of scenes that didn't have interruption from the audience, and the musical that we would do would be 20, 25 minutes of no interruption from the audience at all. No stopping to get a new suggestion. So it was a mix of long form and short form, but, I had enough theater background and musical theater background that I could, I wasn't needed to know how the beats of the Herald or something. Like, I didn't need to know that to be able to do my job at that point. Not at first. Especially since, with short form improv, the games are known ahead of time, and I would just know, okay, with this kind of game, I have to have this kind of I'm either going to be upbeat, or I'm going to be slow, or, oh, I have to be prepared to play the cowboy music or play horror music, or, like, you know, you can get by. The more we did it and the more time I had with the show, the more I would gravitate to the big improvised musical that we would do within the show, the 20, 25 minute part that became the best part. And watching what would work and what wouldn't work from the cast, because they're all improvisers and they all knew what they were doing. I'm no dummy, and I could see, all right, when people were denying offers or when they were trying to push a joke too far, sometimes it wouldn't work. But if they were listening and if they were taking the offer from someone else and building upon it, it would work. And it was being at my place, it was such an important part of my job as the music director to control the whole pace of the show. So if something was, if a moment in the show, in the show in general, I had to control the pace of, but the improvised musical that was happening in the show, if I felt at the keys that, oh wait, this is going a little slow, I would play something or I would do something that would inspire them to move it to the next beat. Or if I felt like, oh, we need to change the scene, I could play music that would be, oh, this is a scene change music. We need to go to the next scene. Let's have an edit. Let's have a wipe. And we can start it. I was making those calls from the piano, kind of like a director would. It was that kind of on the job education to see what works and what doesn't in front of a paying audience. And these are not, you know, these are not your friends coming to the show. I mean, these are, you know, these are big theaters. These are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people in the audience. Having that kind of on-the-job education, when it came time years later for me to be like, oh, what's in a level two class of improv? Oh, what is this? What's the Herald? What is? It was like, oh, I've seen all this. I know what all this is. Like, I see what works about it and what doesn't work. And it wasn't in a classroom experience where there isn't an audience except for the showcase, where it's your parents and your best friends who are coming to see it. Instead, it's a paying audience that just saw the touring show of Grease that came through, and now they're seeing this show, and it's got to be the same quality. You know what I mean? So, having that kind of on the job education with it, I felt very grateful. And I learned a heck of a lot about improv.
Yeah. Now, you have continued to stay in the improv world. I mean, not all of the work that you've done throughout your career is, you know, musical improv, but, you know, that's definitely the scene that you stayed in. Why didn't you, I don't know, try to find a musical director job on Broadway or other things? I mean, you were in New York, and yet, as spoiler alert, you don't live in New York anymore, right?
No.
So, like, how did your dreams evolve / the real life convince you needed to do something else? What was going on?
It was that improvised musical. It was knowing that, hey, we can make up a musical right now, and it's fun, and it was the parts of it that I really loved were when it wasn't necessarily just about the comedy, when instead the actors would be able to allow the characters or the song to not necessarily be overtly comedic, to have it just be a real emotional moment. The mission with Chicago City Limits was not to have some big dramatic musical, right? I mean, it's a comedy show. So more often than not, and appropriately so, they were going for jokes and going for laughs, even though it would, even with the music. But occasionally, I would certainly try and allow some of the song moments to not be necessarily comic, to have them be serious. And as that would happen, I'm like, wow, this is what I want to have an improvised musical show that isn't a comedy show. I want to improvise a musical. I just want to have an improvised musical show. That's what I want to do. I want to do improvised musical theater. And over the course of working with Chicago City Limits, I realized this is what I want to do. And so I started finding ways to increase my musical improv outlet with other improvisers in New York City. So I was working with people at UCB. I was working with people at the Pit. Magnet hadn't started yet, but working with people at the Pit. I had a show called the Monday Night Musical, which was just an improvised musical show that happened to be on Monday night. it was all my improvising friends. Like, something that I felt really, really grateful for now, especially, is that at that time in the aughts, late 90s and the aughts, you had two real big comedy scenes, right? You had the short form comedy scene of Chicago City Limits, which was much bigger in the 80s and 90s than it was in the 90s, 2000s. It was starting to lessen. But then you had the Upright Citizens Brigade, the UCB Theater, and that was, and they showed up around that time, and they were just explosive. And the first generation of students that were learning from the original UCB people, Amy Toller and Matt Walsh and those folks, the original class that were learning from them, a lot of those folks were in the Chicago City Limits cast. And they were like my friends, my peers. And so like I had this, like, even though I wasn't an improviser, I had this in to like hang out with all of these improvisers and all these funny people. And I had the connections to be able to, okay, you've got a good voice. Oh, you've got a really good voice. And I know you can improvise. Let's do an improvised musical. I've got this show. And so they trusted me. And so I would do these shows. We had this show called I Eat Pandas was the name of the show. And it was two women, Eliza Skinner and Glennis McMurray, Glennis McCarthy now. But it was the two of them and me on the piano. And we would do a series of musicals within 30 minutes. We would do a 15-minute musical, a 10-minute musical, and a 5-minute musical, just the two women and myself. Even though it was hilarious, they also were they were exploring and doing very serious kinds of songs, like very emotional moments in these songs. It was theater. It was dramatic. Having enough of that, I was like, this is what I want to do. I have to find a way to be able to do an improvised musical show. So I knew I couldn't do it in New York City. And the reason for that is because everyone is looking for the next best thing in New York City, right? I mean, like, everyone's trying to make it big, and everyone's trying to everything's a stepping stone to something else. And you're not going to have, for what I wanted to do, you weren't going to have the chemistry of an ensemble that would be together for a long time, because someone would find their gig and have to be gone for 2 months or no, I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore. I got this job on SNL. I can't do this. Stuff like that. So I knew I had to not be in a city like New York or LA or Chicago. It needed to be a smaller place where I knew that once I had a cast of people, they weren't constantly trying to like go to the paying artistic gig that was, you know, They weren't trying to make it big. They weren't in the city that I was wanted to go to be a star, right? So I knew that I probably had a much better chance of having an ensemble that would stick around and we could grow and learn to do this thing that I wanted to do so badly, have this true improvised musical show. Hmm. I was trying to figure out which city I was going to move to do that. And around that time is when I was, when I started dating my wife now. She lived in Washington, D.C. area. And I was like, hey, D.C. has enough of a theater scene. It's cosmopolitan, but it's not Chicago or L.A. or New York. So, and I know that they have a little bit of improv there because I'd heard of Washington Improv Theater. I'd seen them. I'd seen their troops when they were performing in the Del Close Marathon in New York. And so I knew that they, you know, that they were a thing. So I was like, yeah, I can make DC work. So honey, I'm going to move down to DC to be with you. And I'm going to make my show work. And that was in 2006. And, that's when I started the iMusical show, iMusical, the improvised musical. And thankfully, Mark Chalfant, he's the artistic director for Washington Improv Theater. I had a meeting with him, and I said, "Hey, this is what I want to do. I want to create an improvised musical that isn't spoofing musical theater, that isn't satirizing musical theater, but we're creating a musical, and it just happens to be improvised, but we're creating a musical." And he was totally on board with it, and that was in 2006, and now this is our 15th year of doing the show.
So. Wow. It's amazing that it started with this idea of creating this show. I like that. I'm sure in the storytelling of it, your wife doesn't love it, where you're like, and then I had this girlfriend. I decided, hey, let's move near her. She's like, could you tell the story where we were in love? And you were like, I'm going to move for love. Oh, since I've moved for love, here's a brand new idea that I've developed about something that I can do now that I'm here in this city of love.
She was concerned that she was skeptical of me wanting to come to DC. You know, she was like, sure. Wait, you're a performer. You're going to leave New York City. Like she was a little worried about that move. And I was like, no, I wanted to leave. I was going to leave to go to some city, maybe back to the Twin Cities. You know, I'm like, I was going to go somewhere so that I could be the bigger fish in the smaller pond to be able to, because I had enough of a reputation at that point artistically with improv anyway, and definitely with this, with musical improv, that I knew that if I went to a city that wasn't one of like the big cities, I probably could like start a show. I would have enough. You know, I would have enough of a rep to be able to start something.
Totally.
And I was like, I can make it work in DC.
Yeah.
And thankfully she believed me. And so, so there we go.
Plus, like, super secret tip to like people who are listening this far into the interview, like if you do even one random like show in New York, people think it's like Broadway no matter what. You're like, me and my friend did some monologues in a hallway and three people watched us and they're like, oh my God, that sounds so avant-garde. Like, you know what I mean? So the beauty is, you were right. Once you leave New York, if you do anything in New York and you've got like couple of things on a resume, you bring those to another city and people are like, wow, you did this in New York? Whoa, man. Like every time I did not do anything of like artistic importance at all. I mean, I had some great experiences in New York when I lived there, but still now, like, I also left New York around that time, around like 2006, 2007. But I'm still like, you know, when I mention that I live in New York, people are still impressed. I'm like, it doesn't, it's fine. It's like, you don't need to be impressed by this. Like, also, by the way, and I didn't mention this when you brought it up, but like, I also grew up in Massachusetts. So the jump from Massachusetts to New York is close.
It's you like, know about that.
It like makes sense. You know what I mean? I mean, the train, you just take the train so fast, or the Chinatown bus, that one.
Yes.
Oh, so easy. I would go there constantly because it was just so like simple. It was like, I hop on a bus, they drop me off. I'm in New York City. Like, it's like 3 seconds. You know what I mean? Certainly in the scope of like, I'm going to travel 3 hours to go to a major city. But I was like, you know, I moved to New York too with this idea of like artistic grandeur, and then found that it was like a little bit of an intense place. Like, I left, don't get me wrong, growing up in the suburbs of Boston, it was all very intense to the point where I tell people jokes that like when I went to New York, it felt like I moved to Pleasantville or something. I was like, everyone's so nice here. Oh my God. They're so sweet. Everyone's just like dancing in the streets. And they're like, what? It is crazy there. And I was like, oh, I'm from Boston. And like, oh, I see.
Yes.
No one yelled at me today. It was amazing. Like, you know, or when they do, I'm like, this is adorable. You're so cute while you yell at me, New York. Yay. Like, and they're like, what a reaction is that? And I was like, I'm from Boston. Every minute of my life has just been yelling at me. So like,
there's a lot of, you know, it's not like New York is this, you know, saccharine, quiet, calm place.
No, not at all.
But at least the yelling that would happen in New York, it felt like the yelling was a byproduct of, but we have this important thing as well, but we're also yelling. Whereas in Boston, it was just yelling. It was just me.
It's like a fierceness, right? Like, like there's a fierceness, like a thick skin. Like when my, I remember when my dad dropped me off at the first apartment that I lived in and he was like, where am I? I'm leaving you here. It was like a warehouse. And like nothing on the street indicated residential. And there was just a green door. And I was like, I think this is where I live, Dad. And he was like, what? No. And then we like opened the door to like a really long, like creaky staircase. And I'm like, this is amazing. And it's like, my dad's like, oh God, are you going to die here? What is this place? And then like we open a door and it's like, all of a sudden we're in this like artist loft with like murals everywhere. And there's like 18 roommates and they're all like, oh, hey, are you the new roommate? Hey, welcome. And I was like, see, Dad, it's great. And he was like, how was I to know that that's what's inside this like dark, dank, scary, you know? So New York has like a roughness, but because I was from Boston, I already had the like fierceness quotient of like, you know, sort of a rough and tumble situation of like, people are always like, hey, you think you're better than me? I'm like, yeah, I think I'm better than you. That's like my childhood, right? So then when I went to New York and they were like, you think you're better than me? And I said, yeah, I'm better than you. And they're like, I like you. And then that was New York. That was like how I got their friends. They're like, you get it, you know? And I had a nice time there, but you know, it was still too intense. I left Boston because it was too intense. New York was just slightly less. It was like Diet Coke to Coke, you know, still bad for me, but, you know, slightly less so, I suppose, in a different way. It's still, the vibe wasn't right, right? I love your example of like Big Fish. Like, exactly. When I moved to Austin and I could be all like, I don't know if I've mentioned I lived in New York. And they're like, oh my God. Oh my God, this is so amazing. And I was like, yeah, I am pretty amazing. Like, you know, and it's nothing. You know what I mean? Like, again, it was like, you know, we did like no exit in like a, in like an empty building that we probably didn't really rent. Like somebody just unlocked the door and let us in, you know, like, it was amazing how you can do wild things in New York. And then when you go to another place, it seems so magical and exciting. And I mean, my stuff was a lot of weird, random stuff. Yours was legit and great and amazing work. So, of course, when you go to this other city, they're going to be like, what's that? You want a show? Yeah. Yeah, you can have a show. You've been nailing this for a while. Like, we know you're going to be great.
There is confidence you get.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I was in New York for almost 10 years, and I was doing the shows, and I was touring, and there was a time period where, so I was the resident music director for Chicago City Limits for a while, but I also would do the tours as well when they were good tours. I did a lot of it, and almost 10 years of that, as well as performing musical stuff at UCB. One of the fun gigs that we got to do, I got to do with Peter Gwynn. He had this thing called, remember the Free to Be You and Me album? Back in the '70s, the Free to Be You and Me were all like this one. So he had this, he helped make this, like parody of it called Listen Kid. We did that show, and it was fun to work with him. But that was like doing musical stuff. I got to do Anthony Brown Anthony King and Scott Brown. They did Gutenberg the musical, and Gutenberg the musical. It's a backers show. I don't know if you've seen Gutenberg the musical, but the premise is that it's these two people these two people who have written a show about a musical about Gutenberg, and they're performing it for backers to try and see if it can get on Broadway. But all of their research was done on the internet. So they don't know anything about, like, it's all bullshit. So that's the musical. It's brilliant. It's hilarious. But I had the privilege of being able to play like one of the actual backer show for that show. With Anthony and Scott in the roles at the UCB Theater, I got to play that show. So, like, I got to do stuff with real people, which was cool.
Yeah.
So after working with all of these people, then when I moved to DC, and I'm like, okay, I want to do this show, and I know that it's not going to necessarily be hilarious, right? Like, is that we're not going to go for, you know, we're not going to go for bits and jokes immediately. Like, that's like, yes, it will be funny. It's improvised. So of course it's going to be funny, but we're not going for the joke. We're doing a musical. And so it's important that we're having real musical theater, that we're having drama, that we're having emotional moments and connections with actors on stage doing characters that people can believe. And having the confidence to know, hey, I know I can do this. And working with the professionals in New York that I did for so long, coming to DC, you just, at least I think anyway, you exude that confidence, and then people will just, they'll buy into it. And they did, like I said, like we're in our 15th year now of this show. It's so rewarding. I can't emphasize enough how rewarding it is to have this inkling of something artistic that you want to have happen, and to see pieces of it along the way, to see a little piece of it before you knew you could do anything, like when I was at the Hart School, or when I was teaching kids how to make theater at Watkinson, or at Chicago City Limits, when we would make up songs on the spot in the smaller improvised musical, but it was more for laughs and it wasn't real. Or in the smaller shows that I would do, like inklings and hints of there's this thing that I know can happen if only I have the time and the opportunity and the people that believe in it too. And then to actually have that happen, to have the moment, to be able, like, okay, Mark Chalfant says, yes, I will help produce this for you. I've got a theater space that I know we can use. We can have auditions. Yes, direct this, make this happen. And then, And then it happens. And I have the opportunity and it works and it gets better and better. And it is so rewarding to have that thing that didn't exist before. There are musical improv shows all over the place. At least now, anyway, it seems like it's not like it's this hidden thing anymore. Like a lot of people will do musical improv. You can see it, but I don't see a lot of what we're doing in that we're doing improvised musical theater. We're not doing a comedy show. So it is funny, but there's a heart to it. Often the audience will be moved to tears in the right way, right? I mean, because they'll be connecting with the characters so much. And if something dramatic happens, if something sad or moving happens to a character, people will forget the show's improvised. They'll think that they'll get lost in the story. And then every so often you can see people in the audience realize, like, I have the best seat in the house where I get to be when I'm playing this show. Because if I'm not in the moment playing it, I can sometimes from my seat, I can look out and watch the audience watching the actors. And you can see the transition in their eyes. You can see how in one moment they'll be watching and they'll be laughing. And then another moment they'll be watching, they'll be so caught up and worried about what's going to happen. And then their eyes will move and they're like, oh my God, they're making this up. And then they laugh again. It's so rewarding to see this thing that I've wanted it to happen for so long actually happen and actually continue to happen and have more and more people cycle through the show now. I mean, like, we've had dozens of cast members now for the last 15 years. And the show grows and it keeps getting better. It's so rewarding.
No, that's amazing. I'm so happy for you that you like got to create this thing and that it's still running. What are things that you've learned from running such a long show? I mean, most people run like something for, you know, a couple months or maybe a year. I mean, I ran a sketch show for 8 years and that felt very long. Wow. So you're talking about 15 years. That's a long, long, long time. Like, What are your takeaways? Like, if somebody wanted to do this kind of thing and like dig in and like really put in the time and make it a long-term show, like, what do they need to know?
One of the first things is you have to like the people that you're working with. That's the isolated Pete story, right?
Poor Pete.
You're gonna be hanging with these people and make sure you enjoy working with them, because again, like the show that we do, it's not just for laughs. It's funny, but we're making theater and we're making a product. I guess that's another thing too, is that if you want the show to last, you have to care about the product just as much, if not more, than the process. I mean, the process is important because if it's not honest work, then it'll just be empty. It'll be an empty artistic experience. So of course the process is important, but the product is also important because you need to have people who are willing to spend their money to come. And it has to be people that you don't know. Generally, at least half the audience, if not more, have been people who have never seen the show before, who have no connection to anybody in the audience. They just heard that it's a good show. They've heard that it's something they need to see. And so they come. And having that product be something that is professional and something that is worthy of people to spend their money on, caring about that aspect of it, that helps the longevity of making you want to continue to do it, because it's something that you can take pride in that is objective, that isn't just, hey, we had this fun time doing this thing. Instead it was, we made this art, we made this piece of art, and people were moved at the end. Like people had a theatrical experience because of what we just did. So enjoy the people that you're working with, and then make sure you're caring about putting together a professional product. Those would probably be two of the biggest things I would say.
That's some good advice. That's some solid advice. I think that that's really important for sure. Like who you're with and what you're putting into it. I mean, that's kind of everything. But as long as both of those things feel solid, the audience feels that too, and they keep coming back. And the word of mouth keeps going, right? Nobody's like going back to the shows where they were like, I think they were fighting, like during the show.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't a fake fight. They sang, but I'm pretty sure it was real. It was pretty intense. Like, yeah, that's not going to go well, right? They're not going to that. I mean, that goes for like one good Page Six article and then like, that's it, right? And then you're out. They're like, angry people? No, thanks. I'm not going to that show again. So it's wonderful. You've just clearly created a culture and a community within your show that like brings people back. I mean, the actors and stuff, do they stay for years at a time? Is it like a couple of months? Like, how are they involved?
Generally, people will only leave. I mean, we've been so lucky. I mean, people will only leave the show if they're like moving, right? Or if they're like leaving town, or we don't have a lot of turnover in the show, generally speaking. When we audition, it's kind of rare. And I do like running auditions because it's fun meeting people and giving people the chance to actually play and do this rare thing, this rare art form. That's fun, but we don't do it very often because we don't have a lot of turnover in our show. one of the things about enjoying the people that you work with, one of the reasons you would enjoy working with them is because you're all believing in the same thing. I mean, like you're all on the same page as to what the show is, what the tone is, what the work is supposed to be. With our show, very quickly people, the actors will know early, they will know, oh, this is, we're doing theater. We're not cracking jokes. We're doing theater. And they will find that balance between, oh, this is a moment that I could get a laugh from the audience from if I went this way. But if I did that, it would pull the rug out of whatever emotional moment I was building. So I'm not going to do that bit. Instead, I'm going to sacrifice this short laugh I might get in this moment, which would kill because everyone's so smart and funny, right? So like, I'm sure they would, you know, that line would kill. The audience would laugh their ass off, but it wouldn't be right for the drama of the scene. It wouldn't be right for the moment, for the overall story of whatever the show was at that point. It wouldn't serve the character. It would make the character less believable, and the audience, you know, it's. When we're doing these improvised musicals, we're already asking so much of the audience. I mean, there's no set, there's no costumes, there's no, I'm like, we're asking them to not only just believe that, oh yeah, oh, you're not just some 20-year-old, you're the president of the United States. You know what I mean? We're asking them to suspend their disbelief so much already. And then on top of that, we're singing because people don't sing in reality with their thoughts, right? I mean, musical theater itself is such a suspension of disbelief that people will just start singing their dialogue, okay? Or singing their inner emotional moment. So we're asking them already to take so many leaps with us that if an actor in a moment, in a scene, at that point will just do a quick joke or break reality to have a laugh, then we've taught the audience that, oh, this theater, this emotional theater moment that we were building, that doesn't matter anymore. That wasn't real. We were just, see, the laugh that you got, that's what we were really trying to do, is this laugh. And then it pulls it all away. And the actors in our show, they all buy in to what the vision of the show is. We're improvising a musical. We're improvising music theater, and they'll sacrifice that short-term joke and instead build to a moment that now maybe will have a huge laugh 15 minutes from now or 10 minutes from now, because it's earned in this organic or organic way. Or maybe suddenly the audience gasps because now this character has taken such an emotional turn, and the audience has sucked them, they've been so sucked into the moment that they've allowed themselves the vulnerability to gasp. They've allowed themselves the vulnerability to believe these improvised characters enough to allow themselves to be moved, and then they forget that it's improvised and they're just watching theater. That's the mission of what the show is, and you need people that are going to buy into that. So yeah, I don't know where that rambling.
It must have been. It's a great experience for you to have this sort of continuous experience that you get to do these things over and over. And it's really great that you've found a home to provide the opportunity for you to do the show that you were always hoping to do, and to give you, you know, certainly some focus for being the center of this show as well. So, you know, you can get the benefit of what would be what it's like to be a Broadway actor. Everyone's looking at you. Look at this guy. He's so great at stuff. Yes. And now they're like looking at you and they're like, this guy, he like created this whole show. Oh my God. So you like get that, and you get the joy of creating this, you know, music and whatnot. I mean, I know that we're all in the post-COVID world, and you probably took some time off or figured out how to do musical improv on Zoom or whatever. I heard that didn't go well. Yeah, I heard people across the board were like not into that. But I hope you get to go back in, you know, and start creating again.
We've started. We've already had a show.
Great.
We had a show a few weeks ago. We have two shows this weekend.
Great.
So like we're doing stuff.
Good. I'm so glad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
It's nice to know that things are coming back, and also that like you have the strength of mind as a producer, and the theater itself was able to maintain. Like, there's a lot of variables that this last 2 years have shown us happen in theater. And so I'm very glad that you're in the same position, that you have a good spot to be, a home to put up your show, and that you can continue to do it. One final question. This has been really great, by the way, to chat about musical improv and like the experience of you creating it, like so fun. As we mentioned a second ago, like there's been some time, you know, when you weren't able to be doing, you know, musicals and writing, off the cuff with all these people. So like, what is it that you do to creatively fill your cup, like during COVID and then even now? Like, yeah, you're doing your shows, but like, what makes you, you know, excited and ready and like get you in the mode for creating and writing songs? Oh,
well, I mean, it was tough. I mean, like what you said about musical improv, like on the internet, I mean, like there are some people were doing it. The people that were, in my opinion, the people that were more successful with it were successful with it because the mission was not really what our show was, right? I mean, like if it was more comedic and more about getting to a punchline or getting to a rhyming couplet, or getting to something that was going to be a laugh, you could get away with some of the technical limitations of internet lag, because the songs wouldn't have to be as complex. They wouldn't have to be. You could get away with more, and it would still be satisfying as an experience. So it would work. But with our show, it wasn't going to work. Not with real time improv. It just wasn't going to work. So we tried discussing, well, maybe we could be kind of like semi improvising it like one person would record their thing and then someone else would see it and then they would record their thing and put it together. But our cast also skews older. So, and some of us have kids and some of us have jobs, and during the pandemic, you had all of that. We're still in, by the way, hello. It's not over. Not quite over. There are lots of concerns that were not, you know, that were not related to just trying to do our iMusical show. So it was difficult to do anything. It was, we would get together with rehearsals that were just more of just us on Zoom checking in with each other and seeing how we were doing and laughing and learning how to laugh with each other again and tell jokes and talking about what would happen when we got back together. We did put together a small video this past summer. I wrote music and I sang like a verse and a chorus, and then everyone did their own verse and chorus, and then I quickly learned Final Cut Pro and put it all together so we could have our video, and it ended up being a fun experience just to connect with each other for more than anything else. But I'm kind of dodging your question a little bit, because like the answer really is I wasn't doing a lot artistically. The thing I spoke so passionately about how rewarding this thing was that we had, that nothing else was going to do it for me.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't interested in doing anything else. Yeah. I was going to ride it out. And thankfully we figured it out now to some extent. Like now we have vaccine mandates that are coming in, but we figured out ways to be in spaces and masked and people vaccinated so that people, they're hungry for it. They're hungry to be in those. When we had our first show back, the whole house that was in there, I mean, people were distanced in the theater and we hadn't rehearsed. I mean, we had not had a rehearsal, and we did the show before, without a rehearsal. And by my standards, it probably, I would say it wasn't the cleanest show in the world, craft wise, but the audience ate it up. And most of the cast have done it for so long now that it was fine. Like I was nervous. I had that phobia of being in society again, being in with a room full of people. I'm sure a lot of the other actors had that too. But once we started, we broke through, and it felt like putting on old shoes. I know it's a trope, but man, it was comfortable and good. I can answer what's creatively driving me. I can give you that answer right now.
Okay.
I've been training a new pianist for the show, his name's Michael Connor, and he's going to have his debut soon. He's actually from Austin. He's from Austin. He did stuff at Austin. I don't know which theaters, but he's from Austin. but he thankfully he's in DC now, working for the government. He's fantastic, and we're so lucky that he dropped into our laps. He was going to make his debut in the show right before the pandemic hit, and then the pandemic hit, and we've started rehearsing again over the last several weeks, and we're finally at a place where he can do the show. Doing the show from the piano is so difficult, because you're not just making up the songs, but you're also kind of directing the moments and picking when the song should be. And is this the right tone? And do I edit the scene yet? And there are all these directorial choices that have to happen. It can be a challenge for musical improv people who aren't used to doing that full blown musical that we do with those kinds of responsibilities. And he's been doing great with it. And the juice for me now is, so in Hamilton, right, best thing ever, Hamilton, my favorite song in Hamilton is the song One Last Time, the George Washington song, where Hamilton's stunned that George Washington wants to resign. Well, he's not going to run again. He doesn't resign, but he's not going to run for office again. And Hamilton's floored, and he's like, no, I'm not going to run for office again. We're gonna teach him how to say goodbye, because and he sings about how the country will live on when I'm gone. This country will live on when I'm gone, and seeing Mike at the keys for this, and training him to do this. This thing that I've done for 15 years, if I were to decide to like, oh, you know, I've got kids, I've got a wife, I've got responsibilities. If I were to stop doing this, then the show would stop. But if someone else can do it, then when I stop doing it, it lives on. And this thing that like I've wanted to live for decades, that now has for 15 years, it's not just about me. It's this living art that will go on and will keep making great things, even better things, even without me involved in it. It will be this living piece of art. And, that's the thing that's keeping me going, to make this thing live beyond. So
nice. I like the idea of this legacy, the idea of creating art that lives past us. There's something really beautiful. Also really beautiful to ally that with improv, right? Usually improv is fleeting. It lives in the moment.
It's ephemeral.
That's it.
It's just there.
It's in the moment.
But the tone is special. Like the tone of the show is special. It's different.
Yeah.
And if that tone can stay, and if people will come and see the iMusical show 5 years from now, maybe someone else has been trained. Maybe if people can come see this show and I'm not playing it, but it still feels like the same show, the same experience, then wow, that's something really special.
That's the legacy of good producing, good directing. Like, as you mentioned before, the idea of professionalism, if you're starting with that, that's how you maintain. That's how you have shows continue, because you've created a product, and that product is easy to remake because it's totally understandable. And smart moves. You're in like so cool with all the musical knowledge that you have and the magic that you can wield, but also so smart when it comes to like the business of producing a show. Like, great. Awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Travis, for being on the podcast. Thank you for telling stories, for sharing your experience. I really feel like, you know, show producers who are listening to this right now have a myriad of solid ideas and really good advice to like help them create a show that they can do for a long time if that's what they want to do. So thanks.
It's been a pleasure, Amy. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.